Hi everyone and welcome. This is Seek Sustainable Japan. I'm JJ Walsh, your host, and here are video clips from the amazing organic farmer based in Kyoto and Shiga area of Japan, Chuck Kayser, talking about his strategies and hurdles and successes and really inspiring the group at the Minka Summit 2026 to start growing their own food and don't give up on failures in gardening and farming.
This was normal looking field, you know, with all the weeds and the onions on the side. So not a professional at all. But the area in Kutsuki, which is in Shiga Prefecture, it's about 35 minutes from here by car. Absolutely gorgeous, really, really nice. And some friends of mine who are potters had a studio up there and invited me to come up a few times. And I just loved it. In fact, the reason I started doing anything there was because I wanted to buy a little piece of land for my son, who's in front there, to have a place to go on the weekends and stuff like that in the summer, like my dad used to have when I was a kid. And I'm from Chicago, and we had mega snow, and they used to have a lot more snow than they do now, but I'm just a big snow guy, because a lot of snow means no school, so everybody who grew up around me loves snow. So the first year I planted out, and the deer won, you know, because I didn't have a fence. So I was like, okay. I learned that, sucked that up. I got the fence up, and I got some food. So this is how we learn. We fail. You have to fail as a gardener. You have to. If you don't fail, you never learn. So just keep that in mind when you learn. It's my mantra. These are the two guys who kind of gave me my first fields to try out. They were always there to help me out if I wanted help, but they understood that I had to do it my way, and they were really cool about it. You Bet Your Garden out of Philadelphia. He's actually retiring or retired already, and it's hard to find the podcast, but he's great. He talks about lawns, trees, he's written books about garlic, tomatoes, organic farming, stuff like that. He's hilarious. Cush Blanchard, one of the greats, unfortunately has been lost. But he used to do this great podcast, which you can still source, or he's a farmer talking to other farmers. And it's wonderful. It's wonderful. That's how I learned how to do raised beds, things like a Spanish trellis to help me out. Composting, I knew nothing about composting until I heard it from Mike McGrath. Okay, I can do that, got a lot of food waste, and suddenly I got a lot more vegetables. I mean, this was one day harvest, and I was not a farmer, I was not selling produce. I had this much in one day. So you can tell, like, okay, I had a decision to make, what am I gonna do? So I started, I said, okay, I guess I'm a farmer. I got to sell vegetables, that's what it is. And that was about 2017 when I founded the Dory Farmer, during COVID, to sell vegetables. As I'm in Keihoku over that way, Woody Keihoku is one of the good ones, and this is actually the Woody Keihoku place where I sell my vegetables as well. And right now I've got about 15 packs of negi there, and it's a great place to sell vegetables. I really like it. It's a wonderful system, very sustainable, very community supported, and government funded. Another thing I learned is, okay, my buddy who's this guy right here, he came up a million times with me in the farm. He's like, Chuck, why don't you do volunteering? And I'm like, really? He's like, yeah, join this group out of Belgium. And this woman here, Mika, there, she is from Canada, and she and Leo both taught me, like, okay, there's Service Volunteer International out of Belgium, and there's Workaway out of the States. Why don't you just apply as a host? And people started coming. And I was like, this is great, because I was transitioning into becoming a farmer, I really needed a lot more help. And so I had to have a house set up for them, which I've been able to do. And so far, I've probably had over 100 volunteers from all over the world, staying from a week to 4 months. I've now got two people. One is for 3 weeks from World Packers out of Mexico, And one is a woman staying for over 2 months from the Service Volontaire International. And I just engaged my first guy from Africa, from Gambia. He just wrote me randomly, and I'm like, you know what? I'm gonna give you a shot. I'm gonna support you, because I've never had anybody from that part of the world. And for me, it's great, because I can't travel. I'm just living on a farmer's salary, but I get people visit me, so it's really nice.
Over there,
like, no monkeys on
the floor. No monkeys.
That was a big game changer. Monkeys just kicked my tail so many times. So that's when I decided I'm going to do both places. And I literally lost like 10 kilograms just working every day, trying to put a second farm together, 6 days a week, sweating it out. And I also started a fruit garden in Oha, which is just outside of Kyoto City, to grow figs and things like that. So I got really serious into it. But the bad news was I learned that as a businessman, organic vegetable sales is not a way to the top. It's very, very difficult, especially in Japan, where organic vegetables might be less recognized than they are in some places of Europe and parts of America. So the tale that I've learned over the years of networking with lots of other people in Japan and worldwide is that the formula for Japan is han no han ex, which is half farming, half whatever you're doing for money, which I was doing with teaching, so I kind of got back into teaching after that. The Ministry of Agriculture, Forestries, and Fisheries was something I would start to research about. Well, what's the reality behind Japanese agriculture and things like that? And that's when I learned a lot of really bad news, that how unsustainable Japan is for their calories. If you're to eat rice and vegetables and a bit of seafood, you're near 90-95% sustainable with your food if you're all Japan. But if you start eating things like wheat and meat, it's gone. It's absolutely gone. So it's not just bananas and avocados we're importing. And even though there's like chicken farms and cow farms and pig farms in Japan, all their food is coming from abroad. And that has a much higher carbon footprint and caloric value than the actual meat coming from those animals. So I just learned these things, that wow, even though Japan grows almost all its rice, it's 28% efficient. It's like because of all the flour. And that's fine, flour tastes good, but it's just something I think people should know about if you did want to choose a more sustainable path. I gave up flour and meat probably because of this. And just the number of farms that were closing and the number of industrial farms that were just expanding says that that's not a good a good sign for our food system here in Japan. And farming is a very labor-intensive thing. It's hard to do that now at 76. So I feel like our farms are really at risk of losing their viability, and our food system is going to suffer. You know, some people come to me and I'm like, I've never had a Japanese volunteer, but yeah, come on out. And it was great to be able to interact with somebody who is native to this country and giving me their side of what the food system is like and allowing them to see how it could be different. And these two people came out for an internship, and they just worked really hard and were very serious about it. I was very impressed. And then I decided, you know, I should do some events at the farm. And people would turn out. And it was just, you know, kind of low budget kind of stuff. But we went out and picked soybeans like crazy and things like that. And people had fun. And I saw the kids having fun, the Japanese having fun. So I'm like, well, I should do events for Japanese families. I've been an English teacher here for kids since 1998. Let's put these two together. And this has become my main business now. Yesterday I had a Japanese family with a 2-year-old and a 5-year-old come to the farm, spend 5 hours. And we played Uno to warm up, made name tags, and then we went to the gardens, we planted sweet potato slips and green bean seeds, and we harvested all this negi, you know, green onions, and we went back and we cooked together curry, and we went for a nature walk, and then we painted a stone we got out of the river, and then we went to the other big river, learned how to skip stones, made a campfire, and roasted marshmallows. So all in English immersion program, and it's fabulous. It's fabulous to have the kids on the farm. They all love it. You'd think they'd just run wild or be bored or on the screen. I have yet to meet somebody on the farm who's not interested in what I'm doing. And it's not me. I tell them, I'm not growing the food. I'm just putting the seeds in there and helping things out. It's nature. And this is something we can all easily plug into, as well as one day events. And I've had multiple families come. During Golden Week, I'll have a group for the third time of five families from Nagoya driving all the way up just to do an overnight with me at the farm. So I'm really starting to feel some good traction in this program. It's good for everybody. But it's a great way to document my progress. And like I said, I learned a lot from podcasts. I wanted to give something back. And I mean, most of them have like 30 or 40 views. I have one video that's got like 15,000 views. It's just insane, about planting green onions. So just helping some people out, I guess. That's great, and I love it. I do lectures at universities. I did one in Shiga just a couple weeks ago. I'm gonna do the Kyoto University of Foreign Studies in 2 weeks, and things like that. And I also host college groups up to the farm sometimes. I'm doing Oklahoma State in a few weeks at the farm. So I just really found that this is a great place. It's a difficult thing to set up. It's a lot of work, it's a lot of stress and a lot of disappointment and not a lot of profit. But when utilized as a platform for education and for tourism, because I also have people coming out for tours all the time. I'm bringing a woman out in 2 days. It works as a business. I mean, I cannot tell you how many times I'm like, oh, yep, I didn't know what I was doing there. I don't know what that is. Whether it's mold, insect, bug, bird, or beast, I don't know what did it, but that didn't work. So, okay, I'm glad I have 75 other things growing that might still work. Any garden. This is the Old Farmer's Almanac. I don't know if you've ever heard of it, but this was like the Bible for farmers. Every year they put it out and tell you when to plant out, what to plant out, what the season's going to be like. This was before Doppler radar and all those other apps and things like that. It's been going forever. And I think they must be just like shaking their heads like with climate change. This is the hardest thing for farmers, is we have to know when it's okay to plant out. Because if a frost comes and kills it, we're done. We've got nothing. Mm-hmm. We've got to know the last frost date and the first frost date. And with climate change, it shifts now. Mm-hmm. I mean, people that I would talk to just 10 years ago would tell me, no, you can't plant your tomatoes out until May 3rd. You can't do it. And they live by that. But if you plant them out late, then they're weaker, they're not as big, the bugs will get them, and that'll be it. So it's a really tough thing. So there's a lot of stuff you have to consider when you're a farmer, so or a gardener. So what I did is put together like some basic points. Light. A lot of people think, oh, I'll just put my garden on the north side of my house. It's not a good idea. I always want south facing. That's the most sunlight, okay? People think, oh, on the east side is fine. You're gonna limit your amount of light on the east side. You want to have full exposure for the whole day. Duration of the light is important. I'll talk about that. As well as the timing, when is the light there? Is it morning or evening? The season is important. Of course, there's less sunlight in the winter, as everybody knows. And I have 14 grow lights that I use to raise up my babies in the wintertime. So that's another option for people who want to go that way. You can look this up yourself, but this just gives you an idea that you can have as little as 3 or 4 hours of light a day and still get some decent crops. You know, you won't get any fruiting crops, but you'll get some good stuff. 4 to 6 hours, it advances up to 6 to 8 hours when you really get your fruits, like your tomatoes and things like that. Again, this is all available online, but just imagine, the sweeter the thing, the more sunlight it needs. That's pretty much it. So irrigation, a lot of people don't think about that. It's like, I'm gonna put a garden right there. There's no water there. There's no source of water. Rain is not going to be enough for at least for a while for your plants. So I've hauled buckets and cars and wheelbarrows and just by hand. I've run pipes from the mountain water. I've installed sprinkler systems, drip lines, spritzing irrigation, all these things. And the best thing to do is to make sure your water is sorted before you start your garden. If you can't do that, don't start your garden. It's way too much work. And if you can, natural water is the best. It's the best. The alkalinity is really important. Plus, there's chemicals in the city water, so you have to think about that. That's a good idea, to have a rain barrel set up.
How about well water? Do you do anything to...
I have never had to do a well, but I've heard those work really well. Okay. Well, that was a funny one. Because that's also natural water, too. Yep. Major types of irrigation system. So the worst one is this sort of mechanized system that runs on a rotor, and you're pumping water with a gasoline-powered or electric pump and all this other stuff. And a lot of materials needed. But then you have something like drip irrigation like this, which is a bit better. But this is the best, the old system for Japanese irrigation for rice fields. Mm-hmm. I've been growing on recovered rice fields in Keoku for 5 years. And it's literally like, okay, I put a block in the big canal, I open a thing, and it floods my whole field for 3 hours, and then I come back, put it back, and it's done. It's the most amazing thing ever. And I've shown people, I show the kids groups, I show my tour groups, show everybody the system that Japan has set up to make this possible. So genius, so efficient, and so wonderful. So if you can get into that, I really recommend it. If somebody said, hey, you want this old rice field? This guy, Mike McGrath out of Philadelphia, talks about a lot. The raised bed is basically like the level of your bed is higher than when you're walking. That's it, it's nothing big major. So you kind of mound up your soil. But it changes things around a little bit for increasing the surface area of your bed, as you will, as it's kind of convex now, is going to mean it's going to dry out faster as well. So you have to mitigate that. But it's going to improve how deep the roots can go and how quickly, because it's fluffier, it's lighter. That's what plants can really dig down into quite easily. It's better for drainage if there's too much water in the rainy season. Weed and pest prevention, because you can put walls actually up that really prevents the weeds from growing in. And it will save your back a little bit because you're not bending over as far. Mm-hmm. Trust me, I know. But it also might require tilling. So you have to think about organics and economy and plant health. Worm castings, if you can get them, these are fabulous. Mm-hmm. This is not a native species to Japan, the composting worm, but there are companies that are selling them. Actually, I was just recently contacted by a guy, Ram, like, hey, I'm a worm composting company. Is there anything in Japan? It's just interesting. He's like, nope. Bone meal. This is, again, something that vegans will argue against. So depending on who you're growing for, you might opt into that or out of that. I no longer use it because I found it's not necessary, but I've used it before. Seaweed. Believe it or not, seaweed is probably the highest nutrient plant there is on the planet. Because there's so many nutrients in the ocean that this is a very, very healthy thing for your body. And one day I went out on a wakame, it's not fishing, a wakame farming boat, I guess. And what they do is they stretch these long ropes over these bays, and they would put this, I don't know what it is, this knob of wakame root stock, for lack of a better term, every 2 meters or so, and then they just leave it there all year, and then they come out and put it over these special tracks on the boat. You just run over, and the rope would come over, and this big giant wakame would be hauled in, and they just cut it off, like this massive wakame plant. And then they'd keep only the top 10%. They'd dump the rest back in the ocean. I'm like, oh. So I was able to take home a whole pickup truck full of this stuff and compost it from here, and I just threw it right on the garden, fresh, wet. They went, oh, it's going to be too salty. Not at all. Mm-hmm. And it just composted really well in my gardens. I lost that connection, unfortunately, but it is something that you can do. Fish emulsions, again, very, very popular long ago. Hard to get now. The Native Americans often fertilize their corn plants with a whole fish when they would plant the seed. Blood meal, same thing with bone meal. It's good and it's got its bad points. And then coffee grounds. Coffee grounds are fabulous. They're really, really good for your compost. I recommend it. Watch out for the filters though, because they might have plastic. But there's basically two ways, hot and cold. And hot means you're turning it, you're keeping it moist, and you're managing it well, and you're up to about 20% green, 80% brown, or 20% wet and 80% dry, or 20% nitrogen, 80% carbon. That's your mix. You keep mixing that up and everything will work really, really well. I get really hot, and really hot compost is great because it works faster. It kills all the microbes in it, anything from diseases to pests, and it kills weed seeds. So it's really fabulous. If you can get it going, it's a bit of a labor-intensive thing. And then cold is what I do now. I'm just nice and, yeah, just leave it. It'll do its thing in a year and throw it on the farm. But the mix is important. Vermicomposting is using worms or black soldier flies, which are a fabulous, fabulous insect. You might see these longish, almost wasp-looking insects flying around that are black, always buzzing around like a compost pile. Leave them alone. They want nothing to do with you. The only thing they can eat as an adult is rotting fruit. So they have these mouth parts that just are like a straw. So they can't bite you, they can't sting you, they can't hurt you at all. They want nothing to do in your house. So next to your house, they're just gonna live fine. They're gonna lay their eggs right into your compost, and they eat anything. They'll eat meat, they'll eat bones that worms won't touch, and they compost faster than worms, like at least 2 or 3 times faster. Mm-hmm. And the babies, the little maggot things, great chicken feed. Mm-hmm. So if people keep chickens, they also nutrients, unless they're broken down in a certain way. And actually, believe it or not, some of the soil bacteria stimulates serotonin production in our minds, which is why gardeners are supposed to be happier people. Diversity in your soil is good for food production. Healthy soil has benefits for the water, and it stores or sequesters carbon. Mm-hmm. Okay, remember, carbon dioxide is the bad guy for global warming, right? Mm-hmm. So we want to keep that carbon sequestered as much as possible. And yes, you probably know about all these poisons and things like that. Please don't use them. I think it's really, really bad. They sell Roundup in all the home centers. Don't touch it. It's really bad. Very bad for pets. I try to get people that way. Most people care about their pets more than they do their own health. Less watering and less weeding. But the growth is a bit slower because it gets cold, and there is a pause in the winter, as I talked about before. Whereas in lowland Kansai, kind of where I live, into the Osaka area, the winters are cool, not very cold, probably not much snow, if any, but much hotter summers, longer summers. So you have less variety, not as much as I would have. Because you can't really grow the stuff with that needs like 3 months of cold. There's gonna be more pests because your summer season's longer. More watering because it's hotter, and more weeding because the weeds start earlier and die later. But you have a better growing season in the winter because it's just not, there's no bugs, the weeds are less, but the cabbages can really thrive. So something like that works really well. And I tell everybody, beetles are really strong in Japan, which is not so great for the mm-hmm. Japanese farmer, because it's moist soil conditions, high humidity and temperate climate means it's a perfect formula for beetles. Beetles can include the giant beetles, which are wonderful. You know, the ones the kids catch, you know, the kabutomushin and things like that. They're fabulous, they don't affect the plants at all. But their babies do. Their babies will eat the roots, mm-hmm. so you gotta be careful. But most of the time I find the giant beetle grubs are in the compost pot, not in the garden beds. The Japanese beetle, I get them in my garden beds and things like that, but the Japanese beetle doesn't affect any of my plants, the nice green one. It's ravaging America, but mm-hmm. it's not in balance with America, and that's why. Mm-hmm. The Mexican bean beetle is one of the worst. It's so bad. It looks like a ladybug, but it's a bit pinkish, has too many spots, and it's not good for the farm at all. The melon leaf beetle, I think it's Urihamushi or something like that, Urihai. I can't remember the Japanese. It's small, orange, oblong, shiny beetle that just wrecks my cucumbers every year. The solution I've found, I mean, I grow killer cucumbers. I get walls of cucumbers, hundreds of cucumbers out of like 30 or 40 plants. But in a month, all dead. Because this beetle bites the leaves, and they're small. And there's dozens of them, not thousands. But they have a disease in their saliva that gets into the plant and just wrecks it. So if you ever have just dying tomato plant or melon or cucumber plants, that's why. The hack that I found is cucamelons. Has anybody ever heard of those? Looks like a little tiny watermelon, but it's a cucumber. And they grow really well, and for some reason, the beetles don't touch them. So I get thousands of these little tiny cucamelons, and it's a really kind of niche market. I'm the only one who has them, so I'm doing really well with them. And they'll go on for months after the cucumbers have insects will target a certain part of the plant, the leaf, the flower, the fruit, things like that, whereas the stink bug doesn't discriminate. Mm.
leaves. Okay, we've eaten all the flowers, let's work on the leaves. Okay, we've eaten all the leaves, let's eat all the stems. And so these are really, really bad. I think a lot of people suffer from them. Prevent the breeding. That's important. Mm-hmm. Solarization is a technique where you super soak your soil and stretch clear plastic over it, some of the heavy like greenhouse plastic, and you weight it down. And you do this during the summer for at least 3 months. What it'll do is it'll super heat your soil. It'll kill weed seeds, it'll kill diseases, and it'll kill a lot of the insect life that's in your soil. So that's a good way to really kind of reset your farm. I mean, you're giving it up for a summer, but it's going to be better the next year. And I've done that before when I started a new garden. If you have an open field, but you've got a fence around it, you can try to stretch fishing line every meter or so over your head, and the crows will hit it, and they won't be able to see it, so they'll leave it alone, because if they don't trust that. Quite easy. I used to try to stretch nets, but the line is much easier. Mice and moles. Moles and voles. I always confuse them. Then I realize, oh, voles eat vegetables. Moles eat, not meat, but they eat bugs, but meat, okay. That's an easy way to remember. And Japan doesn't have a lot of voles, but they have a lot of moles. And what moles will do is they'll just wreck your garden beds by looking for worms and grubs. So they're kind of beneficial, because they are going to eat some of those beetle grubs. But at the same time, they make these tunnels that might uproot your vegetables and things like that. And especially the rats where I'm growing near me, they've learned, ooh, these are subway tunnels, so I can get the carrots and the peanuts and all these other things. Very clever. So you got to be careful about this. Yeah, they're tough. Other small mammals like tanuki and hakubishin, and there's a lot of alaiguma raccoons, American raccoons running around the mountains of Keihoku. People get them as pets and let them go. And then boar, deer, monkeys. Monkeys. I mean, really. They're just so hard to keep up. But fences, really. And then snakes, lizards, and frogs, which to me are great to see on the garden, because the lizards and frogs help and eat the bugs. The snakes mean, oh, this is a healthy ecosystem. This is one of the top predators. So that's a good sign of a healthy ecosystem.
Thanks for listening to the Seek Sustainable Japan podcast. Thank you to Chuck for all the great insights about farming, especially organic farming, all the hurdles, all the challenges, but so inspiring. I think we're all feeling we can grow some of our own food after listening to that advice. Thanks, everyone. Have a great day.